I'm grateful to your rector for his kind invitation to be with you this weekend to lead the quiet day yesterday and to preach this morning. My rector, back when I was a curate, always said it was wonderful to have guest preachers because it helped the people appreciate the home team. So it's my prayer for you that you will come away with the same sort of appreciation. There are many temptations in this world, but there is a clear tradition within the scriptures of both the Old Testament and New Testament that divides all temptations to sin into three broad categories. It is this threefold view of temptation that gives the story of Jesus' three temptations in the wilderness its particular shape. But before we look at the gospel story appointed for today, we should ask where these three categories come from. The answer, quite simply, is from the beginning. That is, from the book of the Bible whose name means beginning, namely Genesis, and from the story of the first sin recounted in the third chapter of that book. After the serpent has tempted Eve, we are told, "So when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, and that it was a delight to the eyes, and that the tree was to be desired to make one wise, she took of its fruit and ate. And she also gave some to her husband who was with her, and he ate." These three categories of temptation, that it was good for food, a delight to the eyes, and to be desired to make one wise, are elucidated in the first epistle of John, where we find these key verses. "Do not love the world or the things of the world. The love of the Father is not in those who love the world. For all that is in the world, the desires of the flesh, the desires of the eyes, and the boastful pride of life, comes not from the Father, but from the world. And the world and its desires are passing away, but those who do the will of God live forever." The desires of the flesh correspond to Eve seeing the fruit as good for food. The desires of the eyes correspond to Eve seeing the fruit as a delight to the eyes. And what I translate here as the boastful pride of life can be correlated to the fact that the fruit was desired to make one wise. That is, Eve believed it would confer power so that she could rely on her own strength and abilities apart from God. With Genesis and 1 John as background, we can turn to look at the temptation story and see how it corresponds exactly with this view of sin. One by one, Jesus takes on the same temptations that tempted Eve. She had a sort of three-in-one temptation. And relying not on his own strength, but on the power of God his Father, overcomes each one. The devil's opening gambit is to say, "If you are the Son of God, command this stone to become a loaf of bread." Jesus answered him, "It is written, one does not live by bread alone." But why would it be a sin to turn a stone into bread? He's famished, after all. The simple reason might be that God did not intend stones to be eaten. But I think the deeper reason is that the devil is trying to tempt Jesus to use the power that the Father has bestowed upon him for selfish purposes. Jesus has the power to work miracles, but this power is intended for others, not for himself. In John's gospel, Jesus' first sign is to turn water into wine, simply to give joy to others, not to draw any attention to himself. He may have the power to turn stones into bread for himself, but that is not why his power or the stone exists. So too, when we use our God-given gifts not for others but solely for our own benefit, we fall into temptation and sin. Next, the devil led Jesus up and showed him in an instant all the kingdoms of the world. And the devil said to him, "To you I will give their glory and all this authority, for it has been given to me, and I give it to anyone I please. If you then will worship me, it will be all yours." Jesus answered him, "It is written, 'Worship the Lord your God and serve only him.'" All the kingdoms of the world are the biggest delight to the eyes imaginable. But Jesus' rejoinder is that God is the only thing that should motivate us. If it does not come from the Father, but from the world, in John's words, it is not worth desiring. Nothing is worth desiring more than God. Of course, that's easier said than done, but this is why we gather in community week by week, to remind ourselves that God is to be desired more than all the kingdoms of the earth. It is not to say we cannot take delight in the goodness of creation, but that we must not let the created order distract us from the Creator. In this regard, Lent allows us to take stock and reprioritize our lives. If we desire something more than we desire God, we either need to give it up for Lent or reconfigure our relationship to it so that God is at the center. Finally, we are told that the devil took Jesus to Jerusalem and placed him on the pinnacle of the temple, saying to him, "If you are the Son of God, throw yourself down from there, for it is written, 'He will command his angels concerning you to protect you, and on their hands they will bear you up so that you will not dash your foot against a stone.'" This last temptation is a strange one. Essentially, the devil is saying, if you are the Son of God, do something to prove it. In other words, the devil is appealing to Jesus' pride and inviting him to show off. What good is it if you're the Son of God, if you can't strut your stuff? Jesus' answer is again from Scripture, "Do not put the Lord your God to the test." Here again, Jesus shows that he relies on his Father for power. Eve may have been attracted to the fruit because it was desired to make one wise, or to use John's phrase, because it would confer the boastful pride of life. But Jesus has nothing to gain by showing off and nothing to prove. Such are the parallels between Jesus' temptations and the temptation that our first parents faced. But there are significant contrasts here as well. Consider this. Jesus' temptations take place in the wilderness, while Eve's temptation takes place in a garden. Jesus is alone, while Eve has her husband and companion with her, who could have intervened but apparently stood passively by and let them get into hot water with God. Or you might say that Jesus' companion was his Father, who didn't stand by passively, but through the Scriptures actively gave Jesus the grace he needed to resist every temptation. Finally, consider that Jesus was famished after fasting 40 days and 40 nights, while Adam and Eve had every conceivable need for food already provided for, freely and in abundance, in that garden. In other words, the evangelist is at pains to demonstrate to us that the deck was stacked against Jesus, and he still came through his temptations victorious. The message we are meant to take away from this story is simply this. Because Jesus has been tempted in every way as we are, yet did not sin, we can put our whole trust in his grace and love. Whether we struggle with the desires of the flesh, the desires of the eyes, or the boastful pride of life, or all three, Jesus knows what that feels like. Our incarnate Lord is not some distant stained glass figure, cold to the touch and beyond human passions. He knows our frailty and does not despise us for it or merely pity us, but loves us dearly and wishes to restore our full humanity to that which Adam and Eve enjoyed before they were tempted and fell. Ultimately, The only difference between Jesus and Eve is that Jesus knew he already had everything he needed from God in order to live a fully human life, while Eve was convinced she had to have more in order to be like God. But in Lent, less is more. We are invited this Lent, therefore, to put our trust in Jesus so that we may die daily to sin and rise to newness of life this coming Eastertide.